Well, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Oh my, lovely response. Welcome to a celebration of Doctor Who. My name is Erica Ensign. I am a co-host of the Verity Doctor Who podcast. Thank you very much. And I will be moderating our first panel today. I think we'll just go around and briefly introduce ourselves, and then each one of us will speak for 3-5 minutes or so before we get started, talking about our first panel this morning, the long appeal of Doctor Who. And after that, we will jump into sort of a panel discussion, and I think we'll pretty much accept questions from the audience as they come up. So why don't we start over with this end?
I'm Jodi Lynn Nye. I'm a science fiction and fantasy writer. I've got about 40 books and about 115 short stories out, and mostly humorous, but none of it, alas, yet Doctor Who.
I like the yet.
Yet. Ever hopeful.
Yes.
All right. We're just going to introduce ourselves quickly.
I'm Kathy Sullivan. I write young adult fantasy and science fiction. I do have a couple short stories in some of the Doctor Who-related Big Finish anthologies. And I'm in Chicks Dig Time Lords, as Jodi is, and Mary is. And in I have a review in Outside In. And major Doctor Who fan ever since it started playing on PBS.
Okay. I'm Jillian Leach, and I'm a historian in a private company in Ottawa. I've been a Doctor Who fan since the mid-70s, when I actually started airing in Ontario. I just edited a book on Doctor Who in time and space.
Cool.
And, here we go.
My name is Sherry Ginn, and I'm a psychology professor, and I have a chapter in Jillian's book on Doctor Who, my chapter is on Sarah Jane, the appeal of Sarah Jane over the fact that we get to see her for a long time, which I'll talk about later on today. And I've got, I've also written about Torchwood and a whole lot of stuff on Joss Whedon.
I'm Mary Robinette Kowal. I write short fiction and novels. I've managed to fit a Doctor Who cameo into each of my novels. don't tell my editor. She hasn't caught on yet. and I have one story in a Big Finish anthology. So I have one thing that's actually canon.
All right, well, thank all of you, and thank all of you for being here. I guess I will start off opening the remarks. I think for me, the long appeal of Doctor Who it lasts almost my entire life. That's how long it is. My parents stumbled across Doctor Who on PBS in the early 80s. I was 5 years old, and very quickly my mom, who's actually here, my mom and dad are here, which is really awesome, she became an instant super fan. There was no such thing as Tumblr back in those days, but if there had been, I have no doubt that she would have been reblogging GIFs and, you know, posting set photos with the best of them. So I grew up with Doctor Who in my house. It is literally a long appeal. Many children had parents that went on business trips. I had a mom who went to Doctor Who conventions. She actually came here to Chicago for Doctor Who conventions, and then fast forward about 30 years later, and my very first Doctor Who convention was here at Chicago TARDIS. So that kind of sort of, you know, crazy history repeating itself thing never would have happened without a show with the kind of interesting, flexible history that made it possible to continue and continue. And then when it stopped, continuing, even though it was stopped, which is pretty amazing. I have friends, actually, that are completely new to the show as of this year. Just started with Series 7B, and they are jumping in and getting swept up in the magic just as much as I did back in 1983 as a five-year-old. It's kind of amazing. So when the show came back in 2005, I was a little nervous. I was more than a little nervous, but it did win me over eventually, and now I am enjoying it every bit as much now as I did the last time I went through and watched everything I could get my hands on in 1994. Just, you know, one of those marathon rewatches. I find it really amazing that a children's show that started on a shoestring budget and then continued on a shoestring budget for so many years grabbed me and my entire family by the scruff of the neck and has done the same for so many other people and just has not let go. And one really just needs to look around the room to recognize the long appeal of Doctor Who 50 years ago, and here we are, all of us today. I think that's pretty amazing. Yes, and as Lynn and Michael are pointing out, Doctor Who actually got me married. I met my now husband on Twitter because of his Doctor Who podcast. And we got married at the Gallifrey One convention this year. So, thank you.
Cool.
All right. Who would like to go next?
Well, I will.
Excellent.
I prepared Merrick's because I've had the flu for 2 weeks.
We did not laugh at you having the flu. It lasted the necessity.
Yeah. Well, I figured the past me is always smarter than the present me, which also holds true in Doctor Who, as everybody has seen. I am exactly of the age to have been watching An Unearthly Child from Behind the Couch when it first aired. So Doctor Who was waiting for me, but I didn't come to it until adulthood, shamefully enough. I started watching about 1979 when the show was scarcely on the air here in Chicago. I had a very kindly friend who lived halfway between here and Rockford, where it was on the PBS, and she actually taped it for me. So six hours on a video cassette. Anyone remember when VHS tapes were $30?
Oh, yes.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. So at that point, I had never yet been to a science fiction convention. It was, but I had started watching Star Trek when I was 10. You know, so I loved what little SF and fantasy was on television, with the understandable exception of Lost in Space. But Doctor Who appealed to me from the very first moment that I saw it. Instead of, well, a pseudo-military setting where the characters land on a planet as a threat or a deterrent, here is a charming man who visited a place because he wanted to. He was a tourist. And that I loved the galactic hobo who was always on the move from place to place, when the budget allowed it, of course. Belonging nowhere and everywhere, carrying his home on his back like a snail. And fearless to walk in almost anywhere he went, meeting people and making a difference, whether good or bad. My first doctor was Tom Baker, of course. Number four, all teeth and curls, as Doctor Three called him. The first episode I saw was the hyper-melodramatic Frankenstein meets Village of the Damned, Brain of Morbius. Bad as the surrounding story was, I fell in love with him and his companion, Sarah Jane Smith, who was and always will be my favorite companion. Although I am really falling for this Clara, who has just turned up. What a darling. Mm-hmm. When Chicago PBS really did air the show, they put it on at midnight on Sunday. They made it as hard as possible for people who really loved it to see it. And in no particular order, I might add. So interspersed with the Baker episodes, I saw the Pertwee episodes, everything from Spearhead from Space all the way to the Planet of the Spiders, but in no particular order. It wasn't for years that I finally figured out, thanks to a convention I went to, what order they needed to go. But as each doctor succeeded to the TARDIS, I followed. You know, how could I not? I was able to catch up with the earlier doctors, at first through many times copied VHS tapes that had been translated very indifferently from the PAL British system, and later on shiny new DVDs and all the novelizations, and now I'm enjoying the new ones, you know, ever since 2005. I've only recently come to Big Finish, but I can tell I'm going to spend a lot of money with them. Unlike the crew of the Enterprise, since I'm continuing this comparison, the Doctor is not constrained by the Prime Directive, but from deeper motives, and he meddles where he sees fit, often for his own amusement, but almost always for the benefit of someone else, and that he perceives to be in need. I've always found his compassion to be one of the main reasons that I watched the show. As a writer, I know that if your audience doesn't care about your main character, you don't have to like your main character, your readers don't have to like your main character, but they must care. Then they won't care whether he or she succeeds or fails. For 50 years, the producers of Doctor Who have given us one after another compelling, appealing, competent, compassionate, deep, funny, tragic comic doctors. We do care what happens to him and his companions. We want them to succeed. Some incarnations were more prickly than others, notably the on-screen Dr. Six, as we've been talking about earlier. And yes, he has redeemed himself beautifully in Big Finish. I really love the new doctors, all four of them, and they're more serious storylines than the previous ones. I really have taken to this new, very young man with an old soul who currently occupies the TARDIS. But they say you never forget your first doctor, and mine is lanky, curly-haired, scarf-wearing, irrepressibly joyous, but deeply responsible, Dr. Four. And would anybody like a
Thank you. They're so fantastic.
I have props. No. Yeah. These aren't the Bassett ones. They're a different brand, and they actually taste good.
I will pass until afterwards, but okay. If anybody
next
else wants one.
All right, so you're finished? Okay, then I'm going to go next because I'm going to keep up with the Star Trek theme. I also like I guess every American of a certain age came to Doctor Who, you know, through PBS when it aired on Saturday, and I came to it through my best friend Chrissy, who was a bigger, much bigger science fiction person than I was, and she's the one that told me I needed to start watching the show, and then of course, and then you know, the rest is history. And I also started watching Star Trek from all those years ago, from the very first episode, which was in September of 1966. So in a few years, we'll be celebrating, you know, obviously the 50th anniversary of Star Trek. And I, you know, and so there are some things that Doctor Who and Star Trek have in common, and of course, the time travel. And Jillian and I were talking about this last night, comparing, trying to compare our memories as to what was going on in the original series. And, you know, in the original series, Star Trek, they went back in time twice. But then it became more and more common. So throughout the next generation, until eventually in Voyager, it's like every time they just got upset, they just went back in time and reset everything. I hate Voyager. And then in Enterprise, you know, the new Enterprise, they had the entire Time War, which they never actually ended or explained. So that was kind of really odd. And then now we have the entire new reboot of Star Trek, where J.J. Abrams has just gone back and he's just wiped out the entire history of Star Trek. And so I think that one of the reasons, and so that kind of makes some of us upset, especially if they keep having Uhura act like an idiot. But that's just my personal opinion, and so I'll try to, you know, not go crazy over that one. I think that part of the appeal with Star Trek, now, some of us are Star Trek fans, and Star Trek has been around for almost 50 years, and I think that the reason that Star Trek appealed to people like me is the characters. I mean, people loved Spock. They loved Bones. They loved Kirk. Well, not me, but anyway, some people loved Kirk. Jillian stood in line to have her picture taken with Kirk, so what can you say? But, I mean, what we liked was the relationship, that these people had a relationship that was on the screen with each other, and yeah, they butted in where they shouldn't have, but even in, you know, if you looked at that dynamic, that was one of the reasons that people turned in. People turned in for the relationships in this particular series, and I think that this is one of the things that that is the Doctor's appeal, that we like the way the characters interact with each other, that the Doctor is personable. Sometimes he's irascible. Yes, he likes to call us monkeys and that kind of fun stuff, but he's right. You know, we are, as far as evolution is concerned, we're monkeys compared to Time Lords. But he likes his companions. He likes where he's going. I get annoyed when the companions fall in love with him because I'm like, is there another story out there, please? But time travel is integral to the show, but the writers don't necessarily keep rewriting history on Doctor Who. I mean, you case in point, Van Gogh still dies. And so what we have is, you know, the time travel is just a way that we can go along with the Doctor and see, you know, and have the fun adventures without it having to be the be-all for the entire series. And I keep harping on time travel because Jillian and I are getting ready to do a book on time travel. So there you go. So shameless plug. We do that a lot in science fiction.
Yeah.
I think another reason for the appeal, and this is something that is that appeals to me, is that the Doctor is constantly changing and the companions are constantly changing. I think it keeps everything fresh for the audience because you have the continuity and you can see the continuity. And of course, we all know how much fun it is to find all the continuity eras. But I think it also keeps it it fresh for the audience also, and we can not get so bored with it. And that's having, it's like, think about all of the television shows that you started watching and then you stop watching just because you're bored. You know, like The Mentalist, will they ever find Red John? Who cares at this particular point in time? And so I think, but, you know, we can say, all right, well, we might be having a new doctor next year, and we might have a new companion next year. And for some of us, we'd like to have a new showrunner next year. So I think that that's, you know, that's its appeal, and that's what appeals to me. Mm-hmm. So I guess I should just say, yeah, I bore easily, sorry.
Bored now.
Bored now.
Okay. So one of the things that I probably should have mentioned when I was starting off is that I work in, for 20 years, I worked in children's theater as a professional puppeteer. And one of the things that I think that Doctor Who has, which a lot of other shows that started as children's shows that people think of as for kids and are really not, is that it is a show that people can watch across the ages. And I think that's really the reason that it has stayed vital across a 50-year lifespan, because you start watching it when you're a kid and you never age out. Sesame Street, for instance, you start watching as a kid, you age out of it, and then there's stuff in it for you when you're an adult. There's nothing for you there when you're a teen. Doctor Who, on the other hand, remains vital across the entire your entire lifespan. And it does that because it's got multiple levels going on. There's the straight-up adventure stories in it. There's the behind-the-couch stuff that you just, I mean, you are there for the ride. And that appeals to, I mean, that appeals to teenagers, that appeals to, that, you know, adventure appeals to everybody. When you get older, you start realizing how many really interesting moral choices the characters in Doctor Who face. And that brings you to a point where you're watching it because it's teaching you more about what it's like to be a person. You're getting that when you're a kid, but you don't know that that's part of what you're getting. That's not why you're watching it. And then, you know, it also sneaks stuff in, like teaching you about history. And it certainly did that when it was first starting off. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was very much, let us teach you history, science, literature.
Yeah.
but it still continues. I mean, how many people were probably introduced to Van Gogh because of Doctor Who? It's like how many people know The Marriage of Figaro because of Bugs Bunny? You know, this is one of the powerful, powerful things about a media empire like Doctor Who, is that it can suck you in with the adventure and then say, and by the way, I'm going to just teach you a little bit. Time, wibbly wobbly. The other thing about Doctor Who that I think makes it appealing, and again, that long range appeal, is the companions. There's something that we call in children's theater the gateway character, mm-hmm. and that's the character that brings you into the story. The companions are the everyman. What they're telling you is that any person in the right circumstances can be exceptional and can have these adventures. And all you have to do is be aware and look for them and be ready to accept them. Donna, I think, is one of the best examples of a companion who does exactly that. I think one of the reasons she was so successful is because she was so ordinary. And that is a really fantastic gateway character. She serves as an everyman. And again, that's something that Doctor Who has done successfully over time. And the style of the character, the style of that everyman, because you know that that companion is going to rotate in and out, also allows Doctor Who to reflect changing fashions in our own world. The other thing that I also think, one of the biggest appeals to the Doctor is the Doctor himself, of course. But it's not just, you know, I mean, it's not the individual Doctor. Yes, I was a Tom Baker girl. Totally, my grandmother knitted me the scarf. I am a David Tennant girl right now. I just, but the thing about the Doctor is that it's not just, hey, I'm amazing, I'm cool, I go out and have amazing adventures. It's that he shows us that we can change over time. Every time he reincarnates, he shows us that change is terrifying, but that you're still the same person. You know, your core person, the person who cares, the person that people love, is the same. And it's very exciting and very rare show that demonstrates that change is acceptable and that change is an exciting, dynamic time in your life and something to be embraced. And that, I think, is one of the long-range appeals of Doctor Who, is what it teaches us about the span of our life. I think that's why it remains vital and has remained vital over this 50-year span. And if they don't screw it up, why it will continue. Not that I have strong feelings about anything in particular. And the other thing that, you know, we all talk about the TARDIS, bigger on the inside and all of that. This for me is the key. Doctor Who and the TARDIS and the companions and all of it, I think, show us that we are bigger on the inside.
Thank you. I know.
Yes. I'm a fan.
Okay. As I said, I watched Doctor Who from the mid-70s, so I'm actually a John Pertwee girl. I've always enjoyed the show. I mean, I think I enjoy a lot of it because it's British and my mother was English, so I have that sort of connection to Great Britain. Also enjoy the British humor of the whole show because they never take anything totally seriously, which actually makes for a better story, because when a story is taking everything seriously, drives you nuts. It's a show I find... It's timely, and when the show was aired, it made a lot of sense to the situation and the context of the period it happened in. So when we watched the shows when they were live, you know, for the 70s and stuff, they made sense for the period they were in. And the ones that we watch now are equally as timely and important. So they approach issues, but they approach them in a way that you wouldn't notice that you're actually approaching an issue. Also think for me, especially, there's a nostalgia with Doctor Who that we continue to watch because we watched it as kids. I can watch Doctor Who now as opposed to some of the other shows I watched in the 70s, which I really can't watch anymore.
They aged.
Oh, Lord. I used to love Hardy Boys all the time.
Yeah.
Had a special of the first season of the Hardy Boys on sale, so I purchased it and I watched it, and I just don't know how I enjoyed the Hardy Boys because it's not quite the same thing, but I can look at Doctor Who and I can watch them. Yeah, well, other than the tight pants, which I still appreciate, I couldn't watch it anymore because it was timely, but you know.
I'm sorry. Tight I just
pants.
Said.
Tight
I
pants.
Said that's Matt Smith's appeal.
Tight pants. There you go. Okay.
Oh, please stop. Please. So sorry.
But yeah, no. But I can go back and watch episodes from the 70s of Doctor Who, and yeah, the fashions are a wee bit, you know, and the special effects are holy cow, but the stories are still there, and so the stories continue to work, and they continue to work. Well, actually, and I think that's because Doctor Who has a great deal of flexibility in stories and an imagination that doesn't date, really, and it's wonderful
timeless
that way.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's timeless and timely. And I'm a historian, so I actually adore the historical element. And I must tell you that I watch a lot of historical dramas, drive me nuts all the time because they always get stuff wrong. Pisses me off. I yell at the screen, but I can't do it in Doctor Who because they're aliens. So I mean, you have to disbelieve anyway. So any little inaccuracy, historically speaking, you can just say, "Well, it's science fiction. It's not history, right?" So I can enjoy the historical elements a lot more than I do when I watch other shows that historical in theme. So that's where I'm going to end it. When I'm open to all.
I said that I started watching Doctor Who with the PBS. Well, actually.
Yeah.
I fell into Doctor Who in the 60s because Chicago area finally got the UHF channel. Mm-hmm. First thing I started running every day for a week, Doctor Who and the Daleks.
Oh, nice.
I got sucked into it with the Peter Cushing movie. It was when I watched it and I really wanted to join. That just seemed so cool to join that. And it was one of the reasons my mother never realized I carried a box of matches with me from then on, because I was going to be prepared. I got sucked into an alien planet. I was going to be able to make fire. Jump ahead 10 years, I had totally forgotten that that movie had ever appeared. And one of my friends decided she was going to get me into Doctor Who fandom. And she sat me down, brain to Morbius.
Oh, perfect.
Matriarchal society.
Yes.
Psychic powers. Sarah Jane Smith saving the Doctor. I'm hooked. I'm right there. A couple of the things that I liked about the show, first off, you were safe. Well, yeah, you got shot at. Yeah, you got kidnapped. But you were safe traveling with the doctor because you weren't always put in danger, and with the budding teenagers, more like, he's not going to make a move on me. He's just going to, we're friends, we're traveling the TARDIS, we're having fun. Mm-hmm. And as a teenager, I was like, yeah, this is cool. A number of the other traits, now you were mentioning Star Trek. The trouble is, with your imagination, you could not find, I could not find myself being recruited to travel in Star Trek. But this big police box landing in my backyard, I could go. I carried a spare key with me. I was going to go. And other traits that I associated, I'm a big MacGyver fan.
Yep.
And it's the same thing with the doctor. He doesn't always have to realign weapons. He could basically make, somebody was make, I think it was on a podcast or something, saying that the doctor could travel. He's one of those people who could save the universe with a toaster and a piece of string. Well, that's MacGyver, too. Basically, using intellect to solve problems instead of weapons.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's one of the major appeals. And I want to close just basically with one comment that Terrence Dix made long ago that still resonates. And yes, some of the writers rebel against it, and some of the showrunners do, but he is impulsive, idealistic, ready to risk his life for a worthy cause. Hates tyranny and oppression and anything that's anti-life. He never gives in and he never gives up, however overwhelming the odds against him. The doctor believes in good and fights evil. Though often cut up in violent situations, he is a man of peace. He is never cruel or cowardly. In fact, to put it simply, the doctor is a hero. And that's one of the reasons I still think that the doctor still appeals to a lot of people, because he's still there to fight for the underdog.
Indeed. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, everybody's talked a little bit already about the appeal of the doctor, but I'd like to get a little bit more personal with that, because there are a lot of reasons the doctor can appeal, but why does he appeal to you specifically? And has that appeal changed over time? I loved what you were talking about, Mary, about the appeal of the show throughout time. Mm. Does anybody else have any comments about that?
Can everybody introduce themselves again? Because we've had a lot of new people come in.
Oh, okay. All right, I will start. My name is Erica Ensign. I am a co-host and technical producer of Doctor Who Verity, a Doctor Who podcast.
I'm Jody Lynn Nye. I'm a science fiction and fantasy writer.
Let's just go around the table.
Kathy Sullivan. I write young adult fantasy and science fiction. Got a couple of things and some Doctor Who-related materials. And Chicks Dig Time Lords. That's these two also.
I'm Jillian Leach, and I've got a book called Doctor Who in Time and Space.
And Sherry Ginn. Let me see. I'm an academic, and I've written a number of books, and I've written on Torchwood and Doctor Who.
Mary Robinette Kowal. I write novels and short fiction. I sneak Doctor Who cameos into my novels, and I have one story with Big Finish, and then Chicks Dig Time Lords.
Yay!
Editor right
there. Editor. Yeah. Tara.
So back to your question, mm-hmm. which was how Doctor Who appeals to mm-hmm. to me personally.
Yes.
So Doctor Who actually taught me about time. When I was really small, and this is in my essay on Chicks Dig Time Lords.
by the book.
Which you can pick up later today if you're interested.
When I was really little, you know, I was watching Mr. Rogers, and the table is eye level in this memory, and I went to go turn on the television to watch Mr. Rogers. And there's this strange undulating tube and this music. Woo! I was like, what is this? What is this, a new tunnel for the trolley? And then it ends, and there's a monster. And I went screaming upstairs, and my mother explained to me that, well, it was Saturday, and Mr. Rogers didn't come on Saturdays. And I just thought that you touched the television, that Mr. Rogers was always there. Yeah. And that was my first, time. So when I was in junior high school, I was homesick, and I was flipping through the television looking for something to watch, and that tube was there again. And I was like, wait, I remember this terrifying thing from when I was a child. And the tube ends, and there's this curly-headed guy and this woman, and they're on, and I can't even remember what the episode was, but it was not the monster. I'm like, what is this show? And I totally got hooked on it, because part of it was the curiosity of, when am I going to see the terrifying thing? Which, actually is a lot of what Doctor Who is. When is the terrifying thing going to happen? But it was because of the adventures, because there was nothing else on television like it. Mm-hmm. I think that, as much as anything else, the sheer exuberance of Tom Baker, mm-hmm. and the fact that we were going on mad adventures and I never knew what the adventure was going to be, and also, sorry, the long-form narrative. Mm. That was also really exciting, that you know, every episode ended on a cliffhanger.
Mm-hmm. Some better than others.
Some better than others. Yes. Where are we going to put this plug? There, I found an outlet.
I remember in particular, I think it was the fourth episode of Tom Baker, and I can't remember the name of Blank of the Daleks. He and Sarah Jane have been trapped in this thing, and the poison gas has come in, and he's put her into a trance, and it clears, and he opens his eyes, and with the greatest of joy, he says, "I'm alive." And I loved that. For me, it was having adventures, as Kathy says, because they were safe, because somebody was out there to guide us through these adventures, and we could get through them. I was a very timid teenager. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of things happening in my life. And here was a situation where I could imagine myself in these situations, because there's this big presence here who knows what's going on. And if he doesn't, he has a pretty good idea.
Yeah. How did you feel when you witnessed your first companion death then? Did that just put throw a wrench into that? Or
I was proud of them for having the guts, mm-hmm. to have a storyline that was that true.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It made me sad with Sarah Kingdom, not with Adric.
I was sad for Adric.
Yes, because Adric was my first one.
Things happen. Yeah. Things happen. And to be able to be true to a story like that, I appreciated that they weren't going to make everything milquetoast and Hollywood pure, where everything has always got a completely happy ending, because things happen. Definitely. Most of the endings were happy. Most of the endings came out as in a satisfying fashion where, as Dr. Nine says, everybody lives.
Yeah. Very true. You mentioned, Mary, you mentioned learning from Doctor Who, that you learned about time. I actually learned about death from Doctor Who. I was very young when Tom Baker regenerated, and it's kind of a messed up way to learn about death when you learn about a guy turning into another guy. Yeah. But that was my first experience with it. Did any of you learn anything else that still sort of sticks with you from Doctor Who? Besides, I mean, maybe some of the historical stuff, but maybe something else.
Or better, thinking to carry matches with you.
Right, yes.
Thinking outside the box, literally.
Yeah.
Finding a different way to do things.
Yeah.
When you're a child, you see things in a very straightforward fashion. Yeah. Okay, if I do this and this doesn't go right, then maybe I'm going to have a tantrum or something like that. He negotiated. Mm-hmm. He found a way to solve a problem. He would patch up feuds. He would, instead of automatically wanting to destroy the monsters, and I loved Brigadier Lethbridge Stewart, always wanting to use high explosives on things.
Yeah.
And I adored him because he was very straightforward in his own way, too. He was a very complete character. But the Doctor was always saying, there's another way. We don't have to blow the creature up. We can negotiate. We can find out what's actually troubling the creature in question. And since a lot of shows of the time were, oh, no, just let's blow him up, this was a nicer way to think. This was an adjustment to point of view.
I agree. I think that the first question you asked was what's appealing about the Doctor. He's got the two traits that I like in all my men, and probably my women, if I liked women that much, would be they're really, really, he's really, really, really smart, and he's really, really, really funny. All right, so he's so humorous. I love the sense of humor. And so the things that you learn from him, or that I learn from him, are, you know, brains are important, that you can think through any particular type of problem. And that if you just think outside the, if you just, I mean, you can think linearly, you can think outside the box, but if you just think, be patient and think about it, you can approach the problem and you can find some type of solution where everyone can benefit. And then, and certainly the newer doctors are much darker. Their patience has gone like this, so they're less patient and they're less willing to, think any longer. And, you know, and David Tennant, I know many people love David Tennant as the Doctor, but he was really, you know, he was starting to lose, you know, every ounce of patience.
And
there's
that one moment where he showed no mercy, and I found that out of character for Doctor
right.
Who.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's always good, you know, because before, you know, it's like you've got one more chance, you've got one more chance, you've got one more chance. Here's one thing that we can do. And I do realize that, you know, sometimes at the very, you know, there are probably lots of situations where, yeah, you eventually just have to give up and say, okay, that's it. But that was one thing that he did teach us, I think, is patience, which I don't have any, so.
When you live thousands of years, you learn patience.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also think curiosity. You know, the Doctor, particularly the Tom Baker Doctor, constantly asking questions. Mm-hmm. He was the world's most curious man. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it's like, boy, you get, I would find myself, like, getting to do things because I would just say, hey, what is, you know, I would go into Doctor Who mode, what is this, and can I try it? And people, strangely, will say, sure, sometimes. But if they say no, you haven't lost anything. You're in exactly the same spot that you were beforehand. So it's like it's a win. It's
and
a win
you,
neutral.
And if you do get to try it, you've gained an experience.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like curiosity is great.
And curiosity is really good when you cannot steer the TARDIS. Yeah. Because the early Doctor just ended up somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
it wasn't exactly working right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. And it's not only later on we find out
yeah.
that the TARDIS takes where he should be, but the early episodes... He just ended up somewhere, mm-hmm. and okay, let's explore. Let's
mm-hmm.
go see what's here.
Yeah.
Oh, there's something pointing a gun at me. Hello, are you friendly? So
yeah.
it's more of making the best of the situation, just exploring what's where you end up, because he wasn't always able to plan.
No. I actually found the Peter Davison period where the TARDIS was working properly, and like the chameleon circuit came back. I'm like, what?
But it didn't work right, so I was okay with it.
Yeah. It's a shrub. It's a statue.
It was very
it's an organ.
Right. Yeah. An organ in the middle of the street.
Yeah.
But there was a brief period where it was working correctly before they started bringing the comedy in. Because I remember a couple of episodes where I'm like, wait, they really can't see it because the chameleon circuit worked.
Yeah.
Who?
I liked the respect the Doctor had for people who were really not as smart as him, because he's the smartest dude, but he always asked people questions. He generally treated people with respect, even though they sometimes made really stupid decisions or said stupid things. And his companions, who are clearly not as smart as he is, somehow still have an equal role in his universe. So there's that respect that he holds to other people. I think that was a very good example of, you know, watching people interact, where they took that other people have gifts, they're not just necessarily super smart, you know, but you took what you got and you dealt with it. And
it seemed like quite often when he had a companion that was as smart as he was, or smarter,
yeah.
that was when he would sometimes give them the most stick.
Yeah.
Because, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So talking about the long appeal of Doctor Who, I'd like to touch on the so-called wilderness years a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
There's an awful lot going on in Doctor Who, even though it wasn't on television.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I'd like you guys to talk a little bit about that, what you think made the show grab people enough that they kept doing things, and what came out of that, if there's anything that really appealed to you guys.
I have to say, I was unaware of the things that were going on behind the scenes.
I was too.
It's busy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I only heard about Big Finish in the last couple of years, thanks to Lynn. And because I have written very few items of fan fiction, I think all of 12, but most of them are Doctor Who.
They're all good.
Yeah.
Speaking of somebody who has fanzines.
Yeah.
You probably do. You probably have copies of Traveling Companion.
I do.
We tried to keep the spirit alive outside of it because we had no choice. There was none of it on the air. We were watching reruns. We had our own VHS tapes, which we had lovingly gone over. It was not being aired much of the time because Lionheart Productions, who had bought the rights to do it, to distribute it from the BBC, had raised their prices so high that most public broadcast stations could not afford to air it.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the reasons why Rockford had it and Chicago didn't,
mm-hmm.
because they had such a lot of in-house production that they were doing. But Rockford knew that people were not going to subscribe to public television or pay anything unless they had something really appealing like Doctor Who. We were doing our best to sort of hang on to the ideal, to have in our own mind adventures that we shared amongst ourselves that were not, it wasn't on the air. So as far as I knew, it was a wilderness. I didn't realize that there was anything else going on, and I am so glad.
Yes. I remember how wild the internet was at that time, because that was a lot of the Records Doctor Who.
Pre-internet.
Oh, no, it was 89, because that was Records Doctor Who. There was a number of the news groups. There was, the audio started in 99, but there were a couple of the charity anthologies that were starting up. I had a short story in one of those, which is why I remember it. Hmm. And the Doctor Who, the Virgin books were starting up not too late after that, because I remember I managed to get to a British convention, and the highlight of that, other than discovering that there's all guys there, was one of the editors for Virgin Books was actually recruiting people, and they were basically some of the guidelines, and then I can never think of the full books.
Oh, I have to put something in that I learned sort of in the middle. Somebody wrote to me recently about my interest in Doctor Who, and they said, I find it hard to believe that most of the Doctor Who fans in the United States were at the time women. And I said, yes, there were a very large number of women. And they said, well, over here in Great Britain, it's mostly men. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so you must be wrong. And there was nothing I could say to that.
Yeah, I find that interesting. Like I said, my parents both discovered Doctor Who, and they both liked it, mm-hmm. and still do, but it was my mom that became the super fan and went off to conventions and stuff like that. I think it maybe does appeal, the show in general, to a little something different here as opposed to in the UK. I know in the UK it was a lot of, you know, what's the monster of the week hiding behind the sofa, whereas here, at least most of the people that I, in my experience, knew, really kind of grabbed onto the character of the Doctor, and that was a little bit more of the appeal. Does anybody else see that
difference? And they wanted to do the stories in between the episodes,
mm-hmm.
too.
Mm-hmm. After all, Doctor 3 was 700 years old. Doctor 4 was 750. Mm-hmm. What happened in those
Except
50
for
years?
The one time he slipped up and said he was thousands of years old. Like, whoops.
continuity error.
Yeah.
And then the next Doctor was, 925 or 850? Mm-hmm. I've forgotten which.
Yeah.
So there's all these interstitial stories that were out there waiting to be told. Mm-hmm. And we could do that.
And fanzines picked it up
fantastic.
Really well.
That is why he is in my novels.
Oh, yeah. Of course, he could be.
Totally.
I'm ready to Regency. Absolutely.
Yes. And the Diane Duane Young Wizard series, he appeared in one of the spaceports, mm-hmm. Dr. Five. But I think it was, the reason why it was popular among both men and women over here was because we had the Star Trek fandom base on. And because women were already accepted in the Star Trek fandom, we had no problem getting into the Doctor Who fandom. And we probably still have pictures of a lot of the conventions back in the day where...
Album.
where the audience was as mixed as here, mm-hmm. which is much better than being freaked out by going to a British convention going, oh my gosh, I seem to be the invisible thing over here. They don't even want to talk to me.
There's a lot of... because Doctor Who was seen as a children's program in Great Britain, and it was not seen that here, but mostly viewed by adults, The men involved were the geeky, unsocialized anoraks, as they're called, the ones who wear the hooded coats and sort of furtively go around, because science fiction's not that respectable, or at least wasn't. Look around at what's on television right now. We win.
Yeah.
Took a while, but we win.
Yeah, We win. Most of what's on television today that's hot has a fantasy or science fiction element to it. And to them, it was this disgraceful thing that only teenage boys got into, and men who grew up from being those geeky teenage boys. So media mm-hmm. fandom over here was largely female to start with.
Very true. Well, we have a few minutes left. Does anybody in the audience have any questions they would like to ask up in the corner?
Hi, I'd just like to tell you that I saw the very first episode of Doctor Who. Ooh.
Ooh, wow. Nice.
I was 4.5 years old. I lived in Ireland when we got British television, so I saw it. Big fan in the 1960s as a child, and just reinforcing what you're saying, when I was growing up, it was mostly boys. Until their early teen years, for other reasons, I gave up watching when I was in my mid-teen years, for other reasons as well, but mostly younger children to mid-teens. For me, the greatest doctor was Patrick Troughton.
Mm.
But turning to just a few comments on the question of the American parallels, surely the greatest American parallel would have been with the time tunnel.
I remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there's a vulnerable individual back in time as well.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there were usually two.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
James Darren and who was it?
Oh, who cares? It was James Darren.
James Darren.
So, I mean, nobody remembers that. I mean, I can see his face.
Tony.
One final thing on the British context for Doctor Who, particularly the recent one, is it's being embedded in the working class, I think, is a very important thing.
Yeah,
particularly the reincarnation.
Yeah.
And the fact that the TARDIS looks like a police box, which in the early 1960s was something you saw on street corners.
Oh, iconic. Yeah. And do you know that they're thinking of bringing them back because they want street policing to be more reinforced?
Wow. So
I wanted to ask about melancholy and sadness as an appeal, because you talked about change and this kind of inevitability of change, but it's actually kind of a tragic story, right? We can't get too attached to a companion because we know eventually the show will reset. We know that every doctor will eventually have to watch them die no matter how much we like them. Mm-hmm. So I was curious how that element of it functions as an appeal to any of you, like the tears that even start to well up during the panel.
Right? Yeah.
Oh,
I'm a weeper.
We love that. That would be one of the things that makes him so real to us is that he has the full range of emotions, and that includes grief and regret and, well, Dr. Fora. Well, I hate goodbyes, because he does, because he's had so many of them.
Mm-hmm.
And when he slams the door behind him, leaving Leela on Gallifrey, I'll miss you too, Savage, but he couldn't say it to her.
Right.
Yeah. And I felt for him there. Yeah. You know, and all of the times that you know he said goodbye, or he should have said goodbye and probably couldn't. And I appreciated that. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, tugging at the heartstrings is a good thing.
Mm-hmm. And speaking about the companions leaving, I appreciated the melancholy aspect of it too, but I also appreciated how that reflects life.
Yeah.
Because as you go through your life, you're not going to have the same friends the entire time. So that may even be another thing that I learned from this show is how to put something behind me and recognize that there might be great more new adventures ahead of me.
That things come to an end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's not a bad thing. It's just a thing. It's the way that it is.
Of course, it's one of these things where you just want to say, but you already knew it. You know, he can see everything in time and space, forward and backward. It's like, well, you knew it was going to happen. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's that continuity era where he always, acts surprised. And then when he tells Rose Tyler, when she says, I can see everything, he says, that's what I see all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, and then there's that telling little comment where he said, everybody died. So,
I choose to believe he was exaggerating.
Yeah,
it was. Middler?
Let me go to what you were saying about a time tunnel, too. For me, I think growing up in the 60s, a lot of American science fiction was very much like Time Tunnel, where the emphasis was on the science. Mm-hmm. And because you had scientists who were the ones who could go back, even if they were trying to get more funding, which you have a theme in Quantum Leap as well again.
Mm-hmm.
And like going back in time. And they were going back primarily, not exclusively, but primarily to American-based historic events. Mm-hmm. So you have things like starting with Titanic, and you go into things like Pearl Harbor, and even though there were some other things, it was very much that kind of, I think, very focused in that and very scientific on it. Do you think that that is a big difference between, particularly when Doctor Who was starting, American science fiction and British science fiction, that the Doctor is more humanizing or is less on the science part of it and maybe more on the fiction, and whereas in the U.S., even though you have Star Trek that did have a lot more character development, you had kind of that emphasis on the space program or on science, rather than so much on character development?
Well, think of the science fiction of the period, where it was mostly focused on the science, and the characters were much more two-dimensional.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, the time tunnel characters were a lot more three-dimensional than a great deal of the fiction of the time, where generic males went off and committed these wonderful acts of science, heroically. I think Time Tunnel was, in a way, a reflection of that. Doctor Who was much less of that, partly because it was British and partly because it was aimed at children.
Yeah. The education of the 1960s in the United States was science and technology. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. We had the Russians, heaven forbid, put an object in space before we did. And you had Kennedy in, 1960 whatever, saying we will put a man on the moon before the end of the decade. So as far as American society was concerned, 60s were the science decade. You know, you look at it now, I mean, I'm sorry, but I'm an academic. Here's like other parts of the, world and where they are scientifically as far as science literacy, and here's the United States. You know, we're pretty illiterate as far as science is concerned now because of the way our education is. We've gotten away from science, which is, that's where all the new jobs are coming open. You know, it's like, if you don't know science and math, bye-bye. And so I think that was the difference as far as the philosophy of the time. And Britain was probably not in that mode, that scientific mode in the 60s like we were.
Thing is also American history is more deliberate, I find. When you talk about your history, you talk about it in more patriotic terms, and the British, and they don't. I mean, they are patriotic, and certainly they're very happy to be British, and they make a lot of statements where you say, yay team, but they're not nearly as deliberate as something like Time Tunnel, where they hit American incidents that are completely tied into your culture and your identity. So I think that's also the difference. They're softer a bit about their history. They're less.
They've got more of it.
Yeah.
Nice boys and girls don't brag.
There's that too, yeah. But yeah, because I've read American histories and I find them very patriotic. And I went to the American History Museum and it was cool and everything, but it was very deliberately patriotic. And I'm not American, so I found it very hard to deal with. So maybe in some ways it's reflecting the way they portray history in British science fiction as opposed to the American stuff where they're a little softer on it.
Yeah, and it's just like you look at. I mean, but in a way, I mean, Doctor Who is also very, it's like it's obviously very, very pro-British because he only ever goes to England. I mean, it's like he didn't ever come to the United States until, 2 years ago?
Cardinal went to the States, but
a very, very few. Yeah. And I can't remember that there is that quote about, it's like, as long as the doctor keeps coming to England, it can maintain the, and I'm sorry, I did not say this, somebody else did, but it's like, as long as the doctor keeps coming back to England, it can maintain the British sense that we still mean something in the world. And this is like talking about like the 1960s, the 1960s and 1970s doctor, and I think it's Wood in Wood's book, but don't quote me on that, where he says that this is one thing that, the doctor reinforces is that Britain still means something.
Mm-hmm. We've only got about 2 minutes left, so does anybody up on the table have any last things that they want to say?
Thank you all for coming.
All right, then we've got time for one very, very quick question. If your question isn't quick, put your hand down.
Okay, yes.
The reason he appealed the United States is because he's like an individual raffle, which is very unusual, say, in British
culture. Oh, that's an interesting thought. The doctor as a rebel.
A rebel right there with a lot of the authority figures.
I would say that's an appeal to us, and it would be something that would cause Britons to say, wait a minute, he is not quite like us, as much as he seems to be like us. That is an otherness. And I'll talk about that narrative later on today.
Yeah, actually, I definitely see that. To the British, it's interesting because it's different. And to us, it's like, hey, that's a British guy that's a little bit like us. Mm-hmm. So it kind of brings it all in.
Sort of in the same way that Avon and Blake Seven is just as appealing to people with that show. Or Lister and Red Dwarf.
My feelings for Avon are very different from my feelings for the doctor.
It's interesting that like all the shows that are British that do well in America, even things like, Father Ted, the hero is sort of this anti-British establishment character. It sort of goes back to the idea of class and sort of almost the, it sort of comes out of that DIY sort of punk atmosphere of the 70s and the late 60s, is that it's sort of the idea of you have a very staid society moving away from the tradition of that. Anytime they do that with a lead character or several lead characters, it somehow stands out above anything else, which is kind of interesting.
Very true. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, excellent. Thank you all so much for being here. It's time for us to wrap it up. More great panels coming today, so stick around or check out one of the screenings in the other room.